This last election cycle here in Washington State legalized same-sex marriage and legalized recreation use of marijuana. Up to now, like with the, some of the same-sex marriage issues that have arisen in states, it's generally required a legislation from the bench because the people would not actually vote for that themselves. So they've had to judicially come in and insert some of those things. But we've reached the point in society where people, members of the electorate, are actually willing to now vote for it themselves. I would say that's a very fundamental change in even culture of our nation. Now, it's easy enough to get up and we can point out social decline in various ways around us, but honestly, that doesn't prove anything about you and me. God doesn't grade on a curve. So you can't map society and then map you and I and the church, and as long as we're keeping our distance, it's going to be okay. Like I say, God doesn't grade on a curve. Our measure is God and His Word, not a certain distance away from social structure or some comparison to the society that we're in. When I looked at the election, I was analyzing what the change was and where that change in perspective had come from. Some of the Hispanic population that were voting voted up into the 70 percentile for what would be considered, I say, maybe the blue ticket. And I'm not assuming that they voted that across the board. But if you took a map of Washington, and they color the maps in the election cycles red and blue. And if you were to take the counties of Washington State and color each county individually, what color would the state be? It'd be red. Now, which way does Washington State vote? Votes blue. Why? Well, if I could say it as openly as the Bible states it, I think, and I will tie into it, basically it's the women and the young adults. The young adults are measured as a political entity from like 18 to 29, what we call young adults effectively, and they voted up around 60 percentile in the blue. And the women voted about the 55 percentile in the blue. So you're not talking something that's dramatically on the scale of one versus the other, but you are talking now socially in various places where there is enough ballot now in those areas to tilt toward the blue perspective in terms of political agenda. Now, the reason I bring that up, because in analyzing, I would like to then go back and look at the book of Isaiah, because Isaiah describes prophetically a circumstance that took place in warning to Israel and ultimately to Judah about social decline in that day, and obviously there's prophetic implications. There are cultural changes that take place based on just simply the environments that we set and the perspective that changes, and I think it has obviously affected our culture today. Isaiah 5 and verse number 8 says, "Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there's no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land." And when you read this verse, it would be easy enough to say, well, you know, that's just a reference to the fact that they're crowded and they can't plant their crops, and therefore you don't have the abundance. Because it goes on, it says, "In my hearing, the Lord of hosts, and truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. 10 acres of vineyard will yield one bath, an omer of seed shall yield one ephah." So there's implication to that, but if you go back, it says, "Woe to those who join house to house." Now, look at a map of the United States. Where is the red? The red is in the agricultural areas of the United States. Where's the blue? Blue is where they have joined house to house in the greatest possible way. There is a cultural change to the big city. And we're seeing the implication of that in our social structure. Now, it was interesting to go down to Lewiston this morning because two of the young adults in that congregation were in the congregations when Michelle and I first went out to Boise from Pasadena. One was in Boise directly and one was in Ontario, the next congregation. The third congregation in that circuit was then called Baker, now called Baker City. And it was obvious to us, if you took the youth group in Boise, let's just say there were problems. You took the youth group in Ontario, there were less problems. And you took the youth group in Baker, and when you walked into church, the young people would walk up and talk to you and visit with you, and you could go sit down with them, and it was more of a rural environment with a family atmosphere. The bigger the city, the more social breakdown there was even in the church. The more divorces, the more broken families, the more young people that were not being directed, supervised, led in that sense by their parents in a more specific way, not working side by side with the family sometimes on the property. And the social breakdown was obvious. It was dramatically noticeable to us. And so down there this morning, Nathan New was teasing Gina Jorgensen that his youth group was certainly better than hers was. But it was interesting that they could look back and remember when we arrived in that way. God says it's a curse to take people and stack themselves up on top of each other in a concentrated manner in a city. Now, it doesn't say the Bible doesn't speak of cities. It certainly does. But there's an impact. You know, you want to ask about that impact, talk to a few of the people maybe on Long Island and see what they think the impact of that is today. There's power just now literally being restored to some of those people, and they've suffered greatly. But again, with all of that comes a cultural change. And with that change, there's a breakdown. Now, Isaiah 3, if we could just go back a little bit. Again, these are references to Israel, to Judah. Ultimately, there's an object lesson for us as well. But in Isaiah 3, verse 1, it says, "Behold, the Lord of hosts, takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stock and the store, the whole supply of bread, the whole supply of water." And what God now begins to describe is if you take away the leadership of the nation, which is the men who are supposed to be heads of their families and their clans and their fulfilling their responsibilities, when you break up the leadership, you're going to have a problem that follows. It says he takes away the mighty man, the man of war, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and elder, the captain of 50, the honorable man. Take away the men from being moral leaders of their nation. Verse 4, "I'll give you children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. The people will be oppressed, everyone by another, everyone by his neighbor. The child will be insolent toward the elder and the base toward the honorable." It happens even in a herd of elephants. If you let the younger elephants to not be under supervision of those who are older and dominant in the herd, it certainly happens in society as well. Verse number 10. "Say to the righteous that it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings." God says, those who serve me, I will indeed protect and care for. "Woe to the wicked, it will be ill for him, for the reward of his hands will be given to him. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. So we have entered what, at least in our state specifically, is a time when those who are leading us are causing us to err and destroying the way of our path. We just saw that in the legislated choice of the people. Now, again, it comes back down to, though, what is it that we need to understand regards to our part in this? So the question I have for us is, where are the men? Is it sexist to ask the question, where are the men? You see, that's where the fault is and the breakdown of the family, is the men have vacated their post. They've abandoned their responsibilities. And the things that happen in society bleed over into us and affect us in various ways. David Holliday, name came up recently in a positive reference, and I thought, well, that's interesting. Let me go see what he has on sermons. And I pulled up his list to see where the sermons were. And he had a sermon, The Role of the Man. It's on the member site. I recommend it to you. It's excellent. I think it's even bold. And yet it's amazing to me that if you just say what the Bible says, because the social system is flowing so quickly in the other direction, if you just say the man is indeed to be the head, that you'd almost have to be careful how you said that, because society has gone the other way. I want to talk a little bit about man and God and the relationship that is supposed to be maintained. Different prophecy in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 22. Ezekiel 22 and verse 23. Let me come back here just a little bit. There it is. I almost went to the wrong chapter. Ezekiel 22. God's referencing the fact that the leaders of Israel have abandoned their responsibilities. And he goes through and indicts them one layer after another. He says, the word of the Lord came to me saying, son of man, say to her, your land that's not cleansed or rained on in the day of indignation. The conspiracy of her prophets in her midst is like a roaring lion tearing the prey. They've devoured people. They've taken treasure and precious things. They've made many widows in her midst. Her priests have violated my law, profaned my holy things. They've not distinguished between the holy and the unholy, nor have they made known the difference between the unclean and the clean. They've hidden their eyes from my Sabbath so that I'm profaned among them. Her princes in her midst are like wolves tearing the prey to shed blood. They're just feeding on the people, to destroy people, to get dishonest gain. Her prophets plastered them with untempered mortar, things that will not sustain, seeing false visions, divining lies, saying, thus says the Lord, when the Lord has not spoken. The people of the land have used oppressions, robbery, and mistreated the poor and the needy, and they wrongfully oppressed the stranger. God says, so I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, and I found no one. And God says, therefore I have poured out my indignation on them. Think of that, brethren, in terms of the church. I sought for a man among them who would make a wall, someone who would not compromise, who would not back down, who would not turn away, who would not fudge, who would not just go along with something because they didn't want to have to face the fact that somebody might not approve, who would not compromise and stand in the gap. And I'd have to say, those men have to be there. Those men have to be here. We have to do that in a right and proper way. Where are the men? We live in a society where the men have been emasculated in various ways. Where are the men in the church? Will we stand in the gap the way God called us to? It is our responsibility. Psalm 119 talks about building a relationship to God and how important it is as a basis to look to God and to His ways. Psalm 119 and verse number 9 says, "How can a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed according to your word. And with my whole heart I have sought you. Let me not wander from your commandments. Your word I have hidden in my heart that I might not sin against you. Blessed are you, O Lord, teach me your statutes. With my lips I have declared all the judgments of your mouth. I have rejoiced in the way of your testimonies. As much as in all riches, I'll meditate on your precepts, contemplate your ways, delight myself in your statutes. I will not forget your word." That is manliness. That is a godly man that focuses on what God's word does say and strives to live it, to think of those things and to implement it in every possible way. My dad was in various ways a harsh man. Not in all ways, but in various ways he was a harsh man. He came out of World War II into part of Korea. And if you went through the war back then and then came back into society, you're going to bring a lot of that with you. So back in the 50s, what we had was a military society in this nation. And it was a yes, sir, society in this nation. That's what existed. And the men came back from the war, and sometimes and in some ways they dealt with things in a very firm and sometimes harsh way. Military discipline. But those men learned to work. God created a man to work, to produce, to contribute. And they brought that back with them as well. The society that my dad came back with, in which I was born into, was a society where the man would take his wife who was pregnant to the hospital and drop her off and then go back to work. Now you think, if you didn't live there, it's hard to believe that's true. It's hard to believe that's true. One of the ladies down in Lewiston this morning says, yeah, I had to get $3 to get a cab and go by myself. She just took a cab to the hospital. It was a society when the men did what they had to and they went back to work. They truly did in that way. Today that seems very harsh. It seems very uncaring, insensitive. But you know what? It was part of that society. There were no birthing classes. Thankfully. You know, my dad never had to go to Lamaze, and I thought of that again and again when I'm sitting there on the floor with this pillow. I'm thinking, my dad didn't have to do this. The men were expected to be strong. They were expected to bear up under duress. They were expected to be physically strong, to be able to labor, to be able to sacrifice. You know, one of our favorite scriptures of the millennium is in the book of Amos, where it says, "The plowman shall overtake the reaper." That's a lot of work. That is a lot of work if you're reaping and you're hustling along because the plowman's coming up behind. The scriptures of the millennium do not portray, as we see in some cases, it says, you know, sitting under your vine and your fig tree. That does not mean leisure. That means safety. It means that no one will make them afraid. That's what the scripture is. So the reference is to being able to be at peace. The reference is not to not having to get up and go to work every day. Labor is what God intended this body to do in order to even stay healthy in the first place. The word couch potato is not a spiritual goal. It is not a high focus. It is not a positive statement. God created men with testosterone, and it wasn't a mistake. When little boys sometimes bounce off the walls, that might even be a benefit later. They're supposed to be able to tackle hard things, face great danger, take risks, and continue to focus and get the job done. That's what men are supposed to be able to do. If you let your strength go, if you do not take care of your frame the best that you are able, you become deficient in being able to fulfill what God indeed called us to do, to be as a man. That is our job, it is our duty to care for, to assist, to protect women and children. Again, even saying some of those things in our social structure runs absolutely across the current of the entire system and would even be offensive to some. But it is still true. Ecclesiastes 5, in verse number 12, says, "The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much." Okay, so the point is not being made that he's sleeping well because he's satisfied in having abundance. He's satisfied in having produced, contributed, labored. He says, "But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep." Man was supposed to work. Man needs to work. Man needs to contribute. Verse 18, "Here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him. It is his heritage." To rejoice in the fact that you got the job done. "As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God." Ecclesiastes 9. We've entered a society by stages in which people want to be, in that sense, taken care of. They want to have the benefit of someone else's labor. They don't want to have to go out and toil, in that sense, under the sun. I remember working in construction before going to college, and I remember one time they brought in a couple truckloads of rebar and dropped it off on the ground, and they were having a little bit of problem with the inventory and making sure that they were getting the orders that they had made, and they sent me out there with a felt tip marker and a clipboard and told me to inventory it. Now, there was something like 15,000 pieces of rebar, and I had to go each one and tap the end of it with my marker as I counted to make sure where I had assessed and then check off everything on the list. I had to count them one by one by one. The job got done. Life went on. It didn't destroy me. I didn't have a breakdown, end up in the hospital. I wasn't on the street quivering, hoping for someone to care for me. I'm not making fun of people in genuine need. I am saying we are supposed to make an effort to be responsible. How hard was your labor, Jerry, until you came to retirement? How many anointings did you have with the back and spasms and the muscles because you're laboring over your head with sheetrock? Now, I'm just saying, you did it. It's good. We're supposed to work and carry our weight. Bible says, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, which doesn't mean that if there's a drought and the crop doesn't come in that you had control of such things, But there'd better be some seed out in the field. There'd better be a willingness to harvest when the time comes in. But it says, if you don't provide for your own by laboring to produce, you have denied the faith, and you're worse than an unbeliever. Because the unbeliever doesn't know any better. And God said, you do. Because this is to Timothy and to the church. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 9, says, live joyfully with your wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. Vain meaning temporary, it's passing, you're only here for a bit. Use it well. Which he has given you under the sun all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life and the labor which you perform under the sun. Rejoice with your wife as you labor and produce to care for and protect. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. There's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. This is a temporary opportunity, and rejoice in it, God says, and use it well. So my dad, in some ways, was indeed a harsh man, but my dad was a worker. He was a worker. He had polio around the time of my birth, and as he recovered from that, he had to learn to literally walk and go through the crutches and the hand braces, and then eventually where he could walk on his own. But he never had full muscle structure recovery, so he had to kind of just be careful. And some of the things, which meant we never played basketball one time in my life. I never threw him a football, a baseball, or anything one time in my life. That's not how the relationship developed. And so there were things that I never understood as a young person about my dad and why he didn't engage in some of those things. But I do know this, there were hard times. With the polio, he lost his job and responsibilities in a car dealership where he was supporting us in our home. He went through various moves. We moved in various different places as he started over. My dad was an alcoholic, and that played out in a way to where all the bridges were burnt in the town we lived in at that point in time, and we had to start over again. But he started over again. And he stopped drinking through treatment, and we ended up in Medford, Oregon, where he was selling life insurance, and it was a new agency, so he had to start from absolute scratch. And you know what? He did it. And then he sold a policy one time that was a large policy, and the individual died before the grace period, and they recalled the premium that was spent. We lost our house, went bankrupt, and started over again. Every time, failure descended on, or by his choices, happened. He started over again, and when he died, he left my mom with a home. He left children whose bills had been paid as they were raised. Each of us had the opportunity to make their choice in this life. There was retirement to where my mom was able to finish paying off the house in time, and when she died, there was actually a small estate because my dad never quit. Now, he was a harsh man, but you know what? The kindness of my dad and the tenderness of my dad was in there. And it took me a while to understand. When God called me into the church and I went to Ambassador College, I left home going, the last person I want to ever be like is him. And I went to college, and God was showing me through the church that, you know what, there is a different way. As Luke's saying, you know, don't make that judgment. You don't necessarily know all the way on the inside, but you need to do your part. You need to fulfill your role. And so I've used this years ago, I think I did use this illustration, but I could not remember my dad ever saying, I love you. I couldn't remember. I'm 23 years old in college, and I couldn't remember. And I remember back as a kid, and you know, mom, dad are in there watching TV, and I walk in, say goodbye, and then I go to bed by myself. I don't remember a story, I don't remember Tucky, I don't remember any of that. But you know what? Life goes on. Men are supposed to be able to carry the burden. Men are supposed to be able to walk through the heat of the day. That's part of what manliness is. Being able to endure those things. Now, I was a child, all right? But it's over. And we certainly did not raise our children that way. We contributed in ways that I never, ever tasted. But anyway, in college one time, I called home. And it was easy to say, I love you, Mom. And Mom would say, well, we love you too, son. She'd say, we love you. And Dad would never say anything. And so one time I said, well, love you, Mom and Dad. And Mom says, well, we love you too, son. And I said, I love you, Dad. And it was just quiet on the phone. And I just sat there for a while. I guess it's been years now. I don't remember if I said it again or if I just kind of paused and waited. And finally, Dad came back and says, well, I love you too, son. It's not that he didn't love me. It was never spoken. This was the man that dropped his wife off at the hospital to have a baby and went back to work. It was a different culture. You know, where he came from, they didn't do those things. So when I came home from college after that and give him a big bear hug, there was always a big bear hug in return. And literally, now this is the same man, and from that point forward, you could not meet him or go home or visit without the hugs and the affection now being expressed. It was there, but he came from a different place. So we're supposed to do our part. We're supposed to contribute in those ways, but where are the men in the church? Are we doing what God gave us to do? Are we sharing the kinds of things that God intended us to share? A man is supposed to be able to express love. God is love. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So that's the highest expression of his love. Do the men, will we sacrifice ourselves for each other, for our families, for our mates, for our wives, for our children? Will we make the necessary sacrifice? Will we do what it takes? Sorting through all the books in my office, and they're all just scattered, and looking down and putting them in categories, deciding which books I no longer need, which I need to keep. And here's Man of Steel and Velvet, goes back to college, is a copy with Michelle's name in it, copy with my name in it. That's a book basically portraying the characteristics of a man with firmness and conviction, and then yet velvet for sensitivity, for courtesy, for patience, and different ways. There's a book on love and respect, which is the relationship, again, between a man and a woman. God says, husband, love your wives, and your wives, see that you deeply respect your husband, because men like to be respected and women like to be loved. And so there's different ways that is expressed. But you know, James 2, mercy triumphs over what? James 2, verse number 10. The family breakdown of this nation is a failure of the men to fulfill their God-given calling. And the fact that the children have become, in some cases, insolent, and the women have taken over in responsibilities in places where they need not have been, is a failure, first of all, of the men. But in looking at that and recognizing it and then assessing our own responsibilities, let us understand that mercy in the end is the answer, not the fact that we're able to somehow legislate and keep every part of what God gave us to do. At some point in time, we're just simply going to have to be willing to forgive. We're going to have to be able to apply it in that way. James 2, verse number 10. Whoever shall keep the whole law, yet stumble in one point, is guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you become a transgressor of the law. So as a man expressing his love, it's not going to be in the end, do this, do that. Children, obey your parents, get in line. This is the order, this is the rule. That is not going to be the end of it. There obviously have to be things that where accounting is made, but the bottom line is certainly going to go far beyond that. It says if you commit adultery, if you do not commit adultery, but if you murder, you still a transgressor of the law. So speak and so do as those who be judged by the law of liberty, for judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. So man, in his ability to stand up to the heat of the day and the trial and trouble of the time or the moment, has to also be able to have the kindness and the courtesy and the patience and the willingness to serve those in which God has given him responsibility in that way. 1 Peter 3 and verse number 7. Talking about husbands and the wives and their different roles. In verse number 7, it's the husband. It says, you husbands, dwell with them, dwell with your wife with understanding, giving honor to the wife. So the men are called to honor the wife, to honor her in ways that give her appreciation, give her respect. To build it, not to tear it down. It says, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel in ways, frankly, more fragile. And God says, you be careful. You be careful with them. Because you're heirs together of the grace of life. Be careful so that your prayers not be hindered. Ephesians 6 brings this down to children. Husbands, love your wives. And husbands, you could say the same thing, love your children. Again, if you go back to my childhood, and in some ways I'd have to say children were to be seen and not heard. I mean, that phrase existed in that day. But it was because, honestly, in some ways, my dad just did not understand. He just didn't understand. I think he understood later. Ephesians 6, 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Okay, it is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, you see, you're the grown-ups, you're the men, do not provoke your children to wrath. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. So teach the children, but don't provoke them. Respect your children. Be kind to your children. We had I don't remember what you'd call it when I was growing up. It was a curfew. You're expected to be in by a certain time of night. Maybe that was midnight, would have been in high school. And if you came in at 1 or 2 a.m., you were in trouble. In fact, you're in serious trouble. One time I came in about 8 a.m. Dad was already up. He was making coffees in his robe in the kitchen or whatever it was. It had to be a weekend or he would have been off to work, so probably Saturday night and then Sunday morning. And he's up, and I walked in the door and I looked at him. I said, you know, Dad, I'm really tired. I'd really just like to go to bed. And he just kind of looked at me and kind of nodded and didn't say a word. I went back to the bedroom and closed the door and stayed in bed as long as I could. He never brought it up again. Never brought it up. He just said, I let it go. Now, I appreciated that. I really did. Because there's, you know, if 1 or 2 hours late's enough to be in serious trouble, well, you could die by morning. So, I mean, you know, he let it go. Men have a God-given calling to love their wives and their children. And it doesn't end in the family. Of course it doesn't end in the family. Men have a God-given calling to be strength and leaders in the church. And being led by women and children is not a blessing because it means the men have vacated their post. It means they're not doing what God gave them. They're not exercising the leadership in a godly way. So men and leadership. Let's look at that a little bit. Some of these obviously relate. You can't slice them out and separate them completely. Jason drove me down this morning. He made the mistake of coming over for dinner last night and staying late to talk up with Michelle and visit. So he ended up driving me down, but he was happy to do it. So we, as we would do with anyone, I talk and work on my sermon in the car, and he's asking him what he thinks about various things. But there's a farmhouse just as you head down before you come into Lewiston, just a few miles back on the highway, on the right side of the road, big two-story tall, that every time I drive by it, I'm amazed. It's empty. It looks to me like you could call up the window people and have them put new aluminum windows, just pull the frames out, put new ones in, get the siding on it, and it would be perfectly fine. It is an old house out in the weather that is empty. Now, I know you'd have problems with electrical and various things, but the honest answer is that house is absolutely bolt, upright, square. Every other farmhouse is leaning or tilting or the walls are falling down. And there's one farmhouse in the entire Palouse. The roof is square on top. The rafters are square. The roof's not sagging. And yet it's just gutted empty from being abandoned. Somebody, when they built that house, says, you know what? I'm going to do this the way it needs to be done. Who knows? I don't know if they built their own house. I don't know if they built it for someone else, but the place is perfect. And I did. I said, Jason, look at that. I've never seen another old house that was so solid and square, even standing there alone and empty. Somebody just did it because it was right. Who knows? I wish I could meet the person. Now, I don't wish enough to go find the person to meet the person because they're probably dead by now. But they built something, they did something the way it was supposed to be. And it still stands there square and upright to this day. I think that's what we're supposed to be doing in the church. I think we're supposed to absolutely stop and say, okay, what is right? What is good? I will do it that way. What is needed? I will assist. What can I produce and contribute to the whole? I will help. That's what we're supposed to do. It's supposed to be so it will last, so it will stand there. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Second Thessalonians 3 and verse number 6 in this case. Paul's writing, he said, we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. We didn't eat anyone's bread free of charge. We worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. and not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. Paul said, we made ourselves an example that you could follow. That's what Jesus Christ did. He showed us what the example should look like. And Paul said, that's what we did. We tried to live our life in such a way so that you could look at us and see Jesus Christ, at least in the value system and in the purpose. God created men to be the head of their family so that they could also be the example for their family. So that the words they say, the child grows up and says, I want to be like my father. So that the wife says, I am pleased to be with my husband. This is the man that stands in the gate and I look to him. And I am pleased to assist. And I respect him. And that respect generates the love as well in return. We need to be respectable. We need to be sacrificial. Ephesians 5 says the husband is indeed the head of the wife. Which doesn't mean he gets to tell everybody what to do. It means he gets to love his wife. That's what it says. Husbands, love your wives. You're the head. You go first. You do it first. You sacrifice first. You be the man. Again, I was chatting with Jason somewhere back in the Army, and I kept trying to sort which school it was or which infantry division it was, but the motto was, follow me. And that's what they tried to drill into us in infantry when they would work with us, like for NCO school or things. So follow me. In other words, you were supposed to be the one that was willing to go out there first. You were supposed to walk point. You were supposed to be the one who looked out and cared for the concerns of the others. You were supposed to take the risk, sacrifice what it took to get that job done, and stay on it until you're finished. You're supposed to do that. Well, that's just military discipline. In the church, God says that's what the men are supposed to indeed do as well. The buck stops here. Harry Truman. The man is the head of the wife, God the Father. Love your wife, do whatever needs to be done, and do it first. So where are the men in our society? The men who love God are godly men, the men who work and labor and sacrifice to get things done, the men who love and express love and show love and concern, the men who exercise leadership. It's not because we're so strong on our own. It's not because we're so smart. It is God's calling. It is our responsibility. And God doesn't give responsibility where he isn't willing to come along too and allow us to fulfill what he has called us to do. Isaiah 40, and verse number 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, that my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. He gives power to the weak. To those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, the young men shall utterly fall, but those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They'll mount up with wings like eagles, they will run and not be weary, they will walk and not faint. God says, I will help you to do what I have called you to do. I will not leave you nor forsake you. So where then are the men? Hopefully, they're right here. Hopefully, you and I will fulfill God's calling that he gave us with his power and strength, but again, in love, in sacrifice, and in service, we will do what God has given to us.